This is KDNK. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh. Colorado health groups are crying foul over claims made by opponents of Amendment 72. Eric Gladys reports.
Coloradans are enduring the typical onslaught of political advertising this election season, and many are familiar with arguments against Amendment 72, a proposal to increase cigarette taxes. Altria, Philip Morris's parent company, has invested more than $17 million in the group No on 72 to defeat the measure. Polly Anderson with the Colorado Community Health Network says some of the group's claims are misleading at best.
One of the claims they make is that the $315 million is locked into the Constitution for pet programs where there's no way of knowing how the money will be spent. And that really couldn't be more wrong.
She points to a full page of ballot language explaining how funds will be distributed. She acknowledges that specific groups to get money won't be known until after a competitive grant process, but notes that programs will be overseen by the state auditor following implementation laws passed by the state's General Assembly and signed by the governor. According to the watchdog group Clean Slate Now, health groups, including Anderson's Network, Children's Hospital Colorado, and the American Heart Association, have ponied up more than $2 million in support of the measure.
That's no surprise. From a public health perspective, raising the cost of cigarettes through a tax increase is one of the most effective ways to help kids never start smoking and to help current smokers quit.
Currently, Colorado kids smoke 7 million packs of cigarettes a year. No on 72 also argues that only 20% of the new tax will be dedicated to smoking prevention, and most of the $1.6 billion already collected from tobacco companies by Colorado has been used on unrelated programs. Anderson says a constitutional amendment will ensure the money goes where it's needed most.
It really does go to those most impacted by smoking. Veterans smoke at higher rates than the general population, and a good chunk of money will go to fund their unmet medical and mental health needs.
Anderson adds, smoking is the number one cause of preventable death in Colorado, taking more than 5,000 lives per year at a cost of almost $2 billion annually, or more than $700 a year per household, whether they smoke or not. This is Eric Gladys reporting for KDNK.
An all-day rescue operation Sunday ended with a 44-year-old Aspen man admitted to Aspen Valley Hospital after sustaining injuries while hunting in the high country above Meredith. Joshua Burneman was thrown from his mule 2 miles north of the Waterbury Trailhead in the Frying Pan Drainage. Around 2:15 in the afternoon, Mountain Rescue Aspen volunteers found Mr. Burneman at 9,600 feet. After determining that evacuation on foot was not possible, a high-altitude Army National Guard helicopter was dispatched from Buckley Air Force Base and transported Burneman to the Pitkin County Airport. There, he was taken by ambulance to Aspen Valley Hospital. All volunteer rescue personnel were safely out of the field by 6 p.m. Award-winning environmental author and journalist Richard Manning, whose work has appeared in High Country News, Harper's, The LA Times, Wired, and other publications, was in Carbondale in September for the Harvest Fest at Sustainable Settings. He sat down with KDNK's Will Evans, host of Shifting Gears, to talk about water. Here's a clip from that conversation.
We're in Garfield County right now, where we're running another great experiment with the water supply of the West, with fracking.
Yeah, and that's interesting, and also a story that I got heavily involved in for Harper's Magazine about the Bakken oil field and the development there, which is entirely fracking. And even there, they're not worried so much about water supply. In other words, it rains a lot more there than it does in Colorado, and so it's not supply. But it turns out that to do fracking, the development is so intense and so labor-intensive that it requires enormous amounts of water, but also enormous amounts of labor. And the wells are everywhere in the state. So we've turned that into a national sacrifices zone, looking for more energy. And that's really what we're all about, is energy. I find that really interesting in North Dakota, because at the same time that we lost literally half of a state's environment to hydrofracking, the other half of the state was converted to corn agriculture for exactly the same reason. So about 40% of the U.S. corn crop doesn't go to food now. It goes to ethanol. And the demand for ethanol started something of a gold rush in the Midwest. So land that was formerly in wildlife habitat, in permanent pasture, in wetlands, has been drained and plowed, partly because global warming allows us to grow corn where we couldn't grow it before. But it's been plowed up to grow corn. And that increased corn has gone to ethanol. So all of North Dakota, an entire state roughly the size of Colorado, has been converted in a matter of about 10 years to an energy sacrifice zone as a result of this.
What's your reaction to that as a man watching this happen and having paid attention to water and rivers most of your life?
If I go back and think about the way we thought about what the future and what would happen over the course of, if I go back 20 years and start thinking, say, well, what's going to happen in the next 20 years? And we talked about alternative energy, solar, wind, and we talked about sustainable farming. And those things are indeed happening in our country. People are doing those things. But the big story has been the role of ethanol in our supply and hydrofracking. So we no longer talk about peak oil, for instance, because fracking oil has created a supply of oil that has wiped out the idea of peak oil. We have enough oil to last forever. And that's the big story. It has wiped all those other changes off the board. It has dwarfed everything else we have done. No one thought that possible 20 years ago, that the change would be so sweeping, so radical, and so irreversible. But that's where we are 20 years later, and still talking about global warming is maybe we'll do something about this in the future. But in fact, all of these things are making global warming much worse and doing it so very rapidly.
And nations who lose their water supply don't last very long.
No, and we're rapidly running out of fresh water on the planet. That's a finite supply. Agriculture has used up most of it. It's much worse in areas like Central Asia and Afghanistan, places like that. The Middle East, certainly, the problems are much worse. So it's, I think, no accident whatsoever that the most violent areas on the planet where there's the most upheaval, Afghanistan, the Middle East, happen to be the cradles of agriculture. That's where irrigated agriculture began, in those very places. And over now 4,000 years, we've so depleted those soils and so exhausted the fresh water supplies that that's where it's beginning to come apart. And those battles over fresh water, and they're not explicitly over fresh water now, but they will be. And eventually we will be talking about fresh water as the finite resource, not oil.
I pay attention to people who have the clarity and stability to make life-sustaining choices. And I'm interested in your perspective on what happens when the level of confusion gets such that people no longer are able to see and make clear life-sustaining choices.
Yeah, that's such a complex question, and we can go many directions with that and grab onto it from many different angles. But one is basic and political. And kind of on the fundamental level of just our political discourse and where we are with that in this country. And I characterize it, and so do a lot of other people, as a Tower of Babel, that we're in a situation where information no longer matters, and that when we try to insert information into the public discourse, it immediately is ground up and spit back out by a machine that makes gibberish out of everything we say. And the current presidential election is a really good example. And we tend to act as if that is an accident or something that we just found ourselves confronting as being a development that was evolutionary. But in fact, the Tower of Babel that we're on, that kind of confused public discourse, was created by design. And a lot of people work
created on created by design.
By design. And a lot of people work on it very assiduously, especially the industry, especially agriculture. And agriculture has invested literally billions of dollars into making sure people are constantly confused with conflicting studies, false studies, studies paid for by the corporations. There was a report in the New York Times this week, for instance, about two scientists at Harvard who had been paid off in the 1960s to support the sugar industry. It wasn't just two accidental scientists. One of these guys became the USDA's head of nutrition, who had been essentially bought off to say sugar did not cause obesity. And here we are, some 60 years later, fighting that very issue. The reason why confusion is so important to industry is because they need to protect the status quo. And if you look at the nation's midsection, what we call the red states, there's virtually zero governmental regulation in those areas now. And there's zero because of the Tower of Babel, because we are so confused that we have lost our political will. And that is fine with them because they just need to operate under the current conditions, under the status quo. To do nothing is all that is required to protect the status quo. So it's our inability to act that counts for everything for them. They mean to tie us up into knots. They mean to make us into residents of a Tower of Babel so they can continue with their current practices.
That was part of a conversation with environmental author and journalist Richard Manning and Will Evans, host of KDNK's Shifting Gears. You can hear the entire interview at kdnk.org.